Very pleased to have Jean back again to lead our discussion today. You may recall she was here in July just before she was hired as half-time consulting minister for the Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church in Heartland. And, she's been serving them since late July, I guess. And she also was here as the introducing our Human Light Celebration on December 23rd and serving as our MC for that very successful event, despite the very bad weather we had that night. She's a graduate of the Humanist Leadership Studies program at the Humanist Institute in New York. You were in the fifth class of the Humanist Institute, which was held at the Ethical Culture Society. And when you were in seminary, Corin Arisian was your mentor. Some of you may know him from his time with as a UU minister at First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis. The General Assembly this coming June is going to be in Minneapolis, and there'll be a special humanist event at the First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis. And I'll pass around this poster announcing that humanist event, getting together some old humanists, important people in the humanist movement, in connection with the General Assembly. Some of Jane's past experiences are quite interesting. She's been an interpreter, translator, editor, writer, family law mediator, and teacher. For example, she taught English literature and creative writing at a gymnasium in northern Sweden, in a small town on an island in the Baltic Sea. Wow. And she's done research for the Freedom From Religion Foundation on breaches of law in the United States on church-state separation matters. And has done various other interesting things. Well, welcome, Jane.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always nice to be here and see other humanists face-to-face. We'll actually say that they are. It's very exciting. When Bob asked me to, if I would be interested in speaking here, I wasn't sure whether I should give a talk or how we wanted it structured, and so we kind of bandied about some options. And so I just suggested that I talk about what it means to me to be humanist and how that plays a role in my being a minister for the congregation that I'm serving in Lake Country UU. And then there's an interesting article I'd like to just read a portion of and then open it up for discussion so that we have a more interactive session. So I'll begin by saying that I've always been a humanist, even though I had great leanings toward becoming a nun. I didn't realize, and I still think it's kind of a jip, that you need to be theistic and Catholic and believe in Jesus and everything in order to be a nun. I think that you should be able to do the work that you think you should do the work of.
Be a Buddhist nun.
A Buddhist nun. Well, I'll have to look into that. I have. That's a wonderful book. I love The Barn at the End of the World. Yeah, there we go. And I just felt that whatever a person needs to do in the world, whatever they feel a calling to do, that there shouldn't be this overlay of having to believe a particular way, but it's the works that should be the most important thing, because what you believe is very private to you. That's your motivation and your resource and your sustenance and your renewal. But how you live your life out, that's public. And I think that that's a very, I think you should be able to determine that yourself. So I still am not happy that I wasn't able to become a nun, I'm afraid. So I became a Unitarian minister instead, which has its own challenges. My mentor when I was in seminary, like Bob said, was Corin Arisian. And like First Unitarian Society here, which has a congregation membership of like 1,200, the First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis, which is humanist, had a congregation size of about 1,000. So it was just about as big. It was very, very big and really wonderful. And when Corin found out that I was a humanist and going into seminary, and I went to a UCC seminary, which was also a challenge for me and for them, Many classes got canceled by questions that I would ask in class. Like, you know, what does it mean that Jesus died for your sins? And then I would really ask that because I really wanted to know, what did this mean? I hear it all the time, and I wanted to understand what it meant. And I asked, and there were all these answers. And then someone would say, well, that's not what it meant. And someone would say something, and they say, well, that's not what it meant. And someone would say, answer, and they say, well, that's not what it meant. And they all went around, and there was big discussion and disarray and arguments, and then the class would get dismissed. And I would be blamed for that because I asked the question. And I just thought, we're all asking the questions, but not all of us are asking the questions. And when Corn was my mentor, he said that if he had the chance to go into UU ministry at that time, which I was ordained 14 years ago, so I started about 21 years ago, I guess, he said that he would not go into the UU ministry because it had changed so much from the real power and strength and social justice, social action core and relevance it had early on, definitely from 30s, 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s. And then it started getting watered down after that. And all the spirituality language came in to play, and just really milquetoasty. And that was the time that I came into it, was during this milquetoast period. Hello. And because I had known about Unitarian, I was raised, my mother is Jewish and my father is Congregational, but I was really raised as a Unitarian without any name being given to it. So it's all I've ever known, even though we didn't go to church because my parents, like most good Unitarians, are not joiners. They were just content to be home and to live a particular life with ethics and morality and reading and philosophy and literature and thinking and discussing and nothing off limits. And being raised as a child of the world, we were told in my family that the gift of being given life was that you need to make a difference in the world. And so we've all gone our different directions trying to do that, which is the crux of Unitarian Universalism as well. So the more I learned about it and read about it, the more impassioned I became and so thrilled about the history and could hardly wait to start seminary and could hardly wait to join the movement. And I haven't been very happy with it, but I'm feeling more hopeful now. I think I don't know a lot about Peter Morales, the new UUA president, but I know that he has a very strong social justice background, and he has done a lot of good things in the church that he was in Colorado and really focused on the congregation being a relevant place in society and not just a feel-good place that you come on a Sunday morning and get to kind of, you know, rub shoulders with people who think exactly like you, but that you are with people who are committed to making the world, whether it's out there world or just around the corner world, a better place for everybody. And that is really that's passionate for me. And so this year, as a minister in the Lake Country UU, they call themselves a church. They talk about the Sunday talk as being a sermon. And so I wasn't really sure what theological grounding that particular Unitarian congregation had. And so I was very, very direct about saying, which I was told by Unitarian ministers when I was in seminary, that I should never, ever say that I'm a humanist or I will never get a pulpit position. And that I should absolutely never, never agree to a talk back because I'll just get ripped to shreds. And so the first thing I say when I speak to any congregation is, I am a human minister and I love talk backs. So I'm not afraid of any of that stuff. And so I've been finding out this year for Lake Country UU, I've been trying to get a sense of who they are theologically, and they're predominantly humanist, but they're also a blend. There are theists, there are lots of Buddhists, of course, because it's a very typical Unitarian congregation that draws a lot of Buddhists. But they're very... But that doesn't really seem to play a role for them as much as social justice, social action work does, which is really great. So this year I'm only there part-time, so this year I've taken my time to get to know every single solitary adult in the congregation and all of the children. So on the Sundays, I have office hours. I'm available for pastoral care. I meet with people. I work way above and beyond 20 hours a week. I mean, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that I'm available to that congregation. And on the Sundays when I'm not there, then I'm meeting with the children so that I get to know them, because you can't be a minister if you don't know the people. So I really use a lot of energy that way. And now I feel that there's a good ground beneath me. And so I've put a charge out, a call out to the congregation this past Sunday, because I had sold 3 of my sermons in an auction in the fall. People gave auctions, you know, beer and jam and dinners and things, and I said 3 sermons. And so people purchased them, and then these are not sermons that have been written yet, and they can tell me what they would like me to talk about. And they lead the charge. They give me, here's your charge. You talk about this, and then they can get as involved as they want to in the creation of the service with me at any level. Mm-hmm. And then I take their charge, but then I get to do the interpretation myself. They can't tell me how I'm supposed to think about it, where I'm supposed to land. They can just tell me what the subject matter is. So the one that I did on Sunday, I was given the task of talking about the common good and the Catholic social teachings. And so I did a lot of research on Catholic social teachings. And since I wanted to be a nun, of course, I was like, this was just right up my alley. Because I knew a lot about the Catholic social teachings. But what I was interested in learning about doing this research was that most people in the pews in Catholic churches have never heard of the Catholic social teachings. And I thought that was interesting because I, this little Jewish humanist girl, knew all about it. And so I talked a little bit about that, but this came right literally at the time when the bishops have now vetoed, did not support the health bill, the health care bill. And there was a group of nuns who did support the health care bill who went against the bishops and called them out on that and wrote this letter of support. Well, of course, the bishops were not too happy about that. And so then they reported on the nuns, and then the cardinal is now doing an investigation on the quality of life that these nuns have because they are a little too independent there. And that, of course, then is completely hypocritical to the teachings, the social teachings of the Catholic Church, because these nuns are supporting the social teachings. Mm-hmm. And by saying that, yes, we might not like the bill exactly the way that it is, but you cannot deny 30 million people the health care that needs to have coverage because you don't like language over here. And so they were really following the rules of the social Catholic teachings, but the big enterprise, the church, the institution, was not, and of course other horrific things that we know about all too well. And so in my talk, I had to step aside from the Catholic Church and say, I cannot feel that as a Unitarian Universalist Church, we should link arms with the Catholic Church. However, if we're out in community and we're all working on the same projects and we come together, all of us, whatever the denominations are, and we're doing the work, that's all I care about. And the rest of it is we all have to deal with our own institutions and where we land, and that's very private to each of us. And we just have to do the political work inside of our own structure, and that's not for me to say, but the work is what's important. And so then what I said is that since I've spent the year trying to get to know the people in the congregation in order to be an effective minister, that this next coming year, where I've been rehired again to be their part-time minister, is to focus on not just a congregation that talks the talk about social justice and how important it is, and food and poverty and health care and things that we all can talk about, and that a handful of people are certainly doing both in social justice arenas, but also as individuals, but that I wanted our congregation to become known as the congregation that does the work. That we don't just talk about this, but that we are known. That's the church. See the church on the corner of K and E? That's the one. Gosh, they're always involved. They're out there in the community, and they're always doing something. And so that's my charge to the congregation, is that we're going to work on, first I started out by saying the eradication of poverty in the United States, which I still think is a very important goal. But having lived in Sweden, where they were a top-down society for a long, long, long time, centuries, the haves and the have-nots, and that were the have-nots are the ones that immigrated to America because they were starving to death, but they have shifted that to being the social democracy where there is no poverty, there is no homelessness, there everybody has health care, everybody has education, everybody has this more than a standard of living, a high quality of living that everybody has the right to. And my charge to myself for the congregation is what I need to find out how that happened. What were the things in place in the Swedish society? When did it take place? What was going on historically, systemically, civically, societally, that was the right moment for that to happen? How long did it take for it to become this top-down government of power and ruling to being this horizontal one? And what were the challenges? And how long did it take? And what are the challenges still today? And I'm going to do the research on that to bring that information to the congregation, because we don't need to reinvent any kind of wheel. There's a model right out there of it working. And I also told the congregation, I don't want to hear that it's not going to work because they're homogeneous and we're not. And I don't want to hear that that's a little tiny country and we're a big country. I don't want to hear anything that's going to say we can't do this, because that's ridiculous. Those are just excuses. We should lead sleepless nights knowing that there's poverty. It's very distressing. And I said, and so, okay, if they felt that taking on the eradication of poverty in the entire United States seemed a little bit too large for our congregation, that I would be willing to compromise and to say that we're going to eradicate poverty in Waukesha County, and that we'll simply take Waukesha County. And that seemed very, like, the right bite size to start with. And by gosh, that's what we're going to do. So that's and that's humanism playing itself out, because it doesn't have to do with, you know, praying and not that we can't be doing that, or if people, individuals, whatever you need to do, but it's about living the life of an individual, a human being to another human being here in the world, and looking them in the eye. And I said, and also we have to know who these people are. We can't be just here in our little confines and our little comfort of our church building talking about them out there, but we need to be inviting people in. We need to be going out. We need to know who these people are, because you know what? It could be you. It could be me at any moment. None of us are spared this, and none of us should be able to literally sleep at night knowing that there's something we could do that we're not doing. And so that's the charge I've given to the congregation, and they have agreed to take it up. So that's going to be our focus next year, the absolute eradication of poverty.
What county is that?
Waukesha County. Mm-hmm. Waukesha County. And the congregation, of course, because it's Unitarian, there are people who are doing these works anyway, and they're involved in the county in the social justice arena and in Milwaukee County as well. And I said, and that's fine and good. That's always the way it is for Unitarian congregations. Individuals are always involved. But I want the congregation to be involved. I want this group, because I said, this is not just a coffee clutch. This isn't some place that you just come on Sunday morning, you know, and get to socialize. You get to do that, and you get to see people that you care about. Yes, isn't that great? And you get to know that you don't have to monitor how you're speaking in the language that you use. Oh, that's great. That's a good, important part, but that's not the reason for its existence. It's a religious institution. What does it mean to live religiously? Religious humanism, what does it mean? It means behaving in the world in a particular way. And that has merit and has something to do with thinking about others before you think of yourself, and to doing what you can. If you possibly can do, you need to do it. And so there we go. So that's my spiel.
You're going to...
thank you.
First Society has to say.
Yes, now, I just want to say this first, because this is very important that I say this. You know, I'm not saying anything negative about Michael Schuller. Michael Schuller wrote this article, and it's public, and anybody can pick this up. So I'm not saying anything negative about Michael. But I was a bit troubled when I picked this up the other day and read this. This is his newsletter article called Rev Elations. And it starts out like this. Conspicuously absent from the Unitarian Universalist lexicon for many years, the word grace has in recent times gained greater acceptance. Singing the Living Tradition, our current denominational hymnal, contains the perennially popular Amazing Grace, despite its gloomy assessment of human nature and its problematic assertion that redemption requires belief. An earlier generation of Unitarian Universalists pointedly excluded this famous gospel number from hymns for the celebration of life, which served our movement from 1964 to 1993. Humanism was in the ascendancy in the early 60s, and many UUs strenuously objected to the nomenclature of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Growing up, I rarely have ever heard terms like sin, salvation, faith, devotion, prayer, righteousness, repentance, piety, and reverence, not to mention God, uttered in liberal religious circles. Likewise, the word grace was accorded the narrowest of interpretations and rejected on that basis. After all, of what possible use to us was a concept that made a person's fate contingent upon the whims of a fickle anthropomorphic deity? The Unitarian Universalists of 40 years ago took great satisfaction in smugly accusing Christian fundamentalists of literalism, but all too often we were guilty of the same transgressions. Rather than claiming commonly used religious language and putting our own stamp upon it, we simply trashed it, often without providing any meaningful substitutes. Is it any wonder that yet today it's hard to convince some people that Unitarian Universalism qualifies as a religion? Words do matter, and grace is one that quite aptly describes not just the Christian, but the human experience in general. Derived from the Latin gratia, meaning favor, grace is also etymologically related to gratitude. The association is significant, for without an awareness of grace, it is almost impossible to feel honestly grateful. The importance of the latter is apparent, even to religious skeptics. For myself, once I'd managed to free grace from the restrictive theological shackles my tradition had imposed upon it, I began to understand afresh its relevance. As a result, I now approach life with a deeper sense of humility, more openness to mystery, and a heightened degree of appreciation. Why? Because openness to grace has made me more cognizant of the continuous stream of favors that have poured into my life. However capable I might be, I've clearly benefited from myriad forms of support and assistance, none of which I did anything to deserve, and few of which I have the capacity to repay. These, then, are just a few preliminary thoughts about grace, our pulpit theme for the month of April. Robert Louis Stevenson penned one of my favorite quotes on the subject, and with his words I will close. There is nothing but God's grace. We walk upon it, we breathe it, we live it, and die by it. It makes the nails and axles of the universe. And a puppy in pajamas prefers self-conceit.
I don't understand that. A puppy in pajamas. I don't understand.
I don't either, but I think it's relating to humanists as being conceited people and those who aren't thoughtful and those who, I don't know, it just felt negative that these words were missing from Unitarian Universalism, and it's the humanist fault that we are missing these things. When I see it the complete opposite way is that humanism really brought such substance to Unitarian Universalism, such amazing substance and core and relevance, because it didn't have language that we needed to use and adopt. Sin, salvation, faith, devotion, prayer, all these things that are out here and all around us, it really focused on, but who are you, and who are you, and who are you, and who am I, and what are we capable of, and what can we do, and what can't we do? And so for this to be that somehow there are these favors and quotes that have poured into Michael's life, which is very all well and good, but to think that that's something that is mystery and magic, and he didn't say magic, but he did say mystery, and that humanists have taken away the warmth and the beauty and all of that language that Unitarian Universalism has, where I think humanism contributes a great deal of warmth and beauty, because it's a passionate way to think about life, to lead the life of a humanist. Because what's more passionate than caring about everybody? What is more passionate than that? And so I didn't like this. It just felt like it's feeding that whole fuel of the humanist being a particular thing that's contrary and negative to being Unitarian.
I know a girl named Grace. Otherwise, I don't know Grace.
No.
I have trouble with a holiday in November. Who the heck are they giving thanks to? What's that about? I can be happy that the crops have been gathered in and so on, but I guess we could thank the farmer for that. But I don't have anybody else, you know, the whole concept of a day of Thanksgiving.
Well, I actually did a sermon on that.
Doesn't float my boat.
It was Sarah Howell Buell, actually, who started that. And she worked for however many generations, I think five different presidents, to get that to be a holiday, because it was actually in the time of the Civil War, and there was all this dissension and killing of people in our nation was becoming divided. And she was saying, we have got to remember who we are as a people and that we cannot be fighting against each other. And so finally, it was actually Abraham Lincoln that put a proclamation of the Thanksgiving in order to say, here's one day of the year at least that we can remember why we're all here in this nation. And that's really what it all came from. So it's an important story. Sarah Hale Buell or something.
I'd like to bring up the word grace. The wonderful song, Amazing Grace. You know the history of it.
I don't.
Well, it was written by a ship captain who made his money by transporting slaves from Africa to the Americas.
Sure.
And after a number of years of doing this, he finally, his consciousness, he hurt so badly that he decided he wasn't going to do that anymore. It was a terrible thing for him to do. So he wrote that song, but he was a very religious man, believed in God. Mm-hmm. So literally he was talking about grace from God. But that's a wonderful song, you know, when I sing it, it moves me a lot. But there is the use of that word. And when I sing it, I'm an atheist. It still moves me. But I don't like the idea that it was, in its inception, it was meant to be grace from God. So how do we deal with that? We have the word that we use.
That's the song, then more the argument of the language in the newsletter. I mean, I have similar things at work. One of my, so shall we say, pleasant chores at work, I have two ultra-conservative colleagues who quote the hysterical rants of Fox News to me more often than not. And one of the sort of things I do at morning break is just take apart the rant, attach rhyme and reason to it, and try to figure out what's going on. So they heard me snort with laughter once. One of the hysterical rants, for example, they were saying it was about the health care reform and all that, and Canada was so horrible that people had to tear out their own teeth. So one of my little things was to ask Snopes about it, and they informed me that Canada's healthcare system does not include dental work. So, technically speaking, this guy was producing an argument for healthcare systems rather than free market. It's today people are using language, and they're using it to abuse arguments. So, I mean, he had a pretty good argument about Amazing Grace. I like the song, too. But what he's tied in there was enough stuff to sort of put a negative slant on humanism. Now, why he's doing it, I don't know.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, as a 50-year member of FIRST before I came here, which was a good choice, I still have a little different slant on that. I was raised in a non-religious household. My husband was the son of a Presbyterian minister, and we started Unitarianism soon after we got married. And I there's times when language bothers me, but I don't think that Michael is throwing out everything. He's just saying, grace is a nice word, and it is when you think in terms of gratitude. And like it or not, it isn't because God gave us, but somehow we, all of us here, and most of us in this country, are incredibly blessed, if you can pardon the expression, by safety, health, relative health, And we did nothing to do. We had nothing to do to make us deserve it. It wasn't by our own efforts. And I think that's what he's trying to do.
Well, but
and
what
he's grateful for.
He is. Absolutely, he's grateful for these things, but he's saying that because of humanism, in its, he wrote it. Humanism was in the ascendancy in the early 60s.
Yeah,
so he really says that all he's saying, I understand what he's saying for himself, that he'd like to reclaim this language that he didn't get to grow up with because of the time that he grew up. But he's really saying that it was the humanist taking it away that therefore has now reduced Unitarian Universalism as not even qualifying as a religion because this language is missing. And all I'm saying is that I don't think that any of us as Unitarian Universalists, humanist or not, should be pointing the finger at anybody and saying this is the reason it is or it isn't what it is. I think that we should also be looking broadly at what does it mean to be religious. I mean, I am a religious humanist. Because I'm a minister, so I'm a religious humanist, but I am definitely, you know.
Well, if it's a historically accurate, you should be able to say it, that this is historically accurate. Is it historic? Did the humanists at one time in the history of Unitarian take it away?
They objected to the language because they did. They objected to the language, but they did not reduce then Unitarian Universalism to not be a legitimate thing to be considered a religion because the language is missing. The language being missing is not making it a religion or not a religion.
Either humanism or the specific living human beings who constitute the humanist community are static. You shouldn't be offended at a criticism of other people with whom your beliefs overlap heavily at a different point in time. And their struggle in context isn't necessarily the same set of challenges that we're in the other human spaces today.
Well, except that this was written the other day. So this is happening
today. It was not an attack on humanism, and it wasn't an attack on today's humanists.
It is, though, in our denomination. It's still, unfortunately, humanists are still not really being seen as a positive and legitimate aspect of this religion. It used to be, but it isn't.
Are not being seen passive by whom?
By the UUA in Boston, by religious leaders. That's the language that gets passed down. So it just needs to be, I just am cautionary when I see this. I'm just thinking, oh, don't do that, because it seems to feed, again, this that there's something negative about being a humanist that is contrary to also being a kind, loving, compassionate person that can be religious. And it's that I'm concerned about within the UUA structure.
So you're saying is what he said resonates with this sense or language, and he's kind of evoking something outside the four corners of his.
Yes, if people don't know all of that history, they'll just read this, and they're going to be able to...
And they'll take it.
Right, and that's what concerns me.
Okay.
That's what concerns me about it.
If you don't believe in God, you can't be a good person.
Yeah, it's that. It's just that language. I just want people to be very careful about this language.
And that raises a question for me. You said the terms humanist and atheist are interchangeable. Are they the same thing?
No.
No, I don't think they're the same.
No, I don't think so either. And then it seems to me that you could be a Catholic and be a humanist.
Absolutely.
And
she said that earlier.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When I did a search about a year ago of the religious humanists, one of the most prominent members in the United States is actually employed by the Vatican. He lives in Arizona, where he is in charge of the Catholic, they have the astronomical observatory there on a mountain, and he's in charge of that project there, but he's actually paid there.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, they have a humanist department in their seminary. But unfortunately, what we hear in our culture, in the broader culture, is we do hear humanism as this negative thing, almost dangerous thing. And I would like for us to be very aware of our history as Unitarians and the part that humanists played in who we are as a denomination, and also to be able to speak in positive terms about what it means to be a humanist, and to be able to say it broadly like that, that you can be atheist or agnostic or religious or theistic, that humanism has to do with the good of people, and that it's humans with or without the help of a God, if there is such a thing out there. That energy that's out there either plays a role in our lives or it doesn't, depending on how we believe in that. But how we behave in the world is up to us, or is visible, human to human. And that's humanism. And I think that that's what we really need to be focusing on, and to be able to explain to people, and to bring the heart and the passion and the goodness of what this is, and that it's not cold and intellectual and removed and crabby, although there are a lot of crabby humanists, but you know, but that it's a very important way to behave in the world, and we need to be able to talk about that.
I disagree with you a little bit. I think to be a humanist, the reason I'm a humanist is because you're important. You do things because you're you, and I need to appreciate that and learn from that, and vice versa. It doesn't make any. I think a theist would say that I'm doing this because God's in you, or God's directing me to that. I would disagree. I'd say to be a humanist, I have to disassociate from there. It has nothing to do with up there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might affect the world, but what really is important to me and what I need to work on is my connection with you, or you, or you, mm-hmm. or the natural world. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that differentiates me.
Well, I agree. But I think you could be a theistic humanist. For example, Jesus... Jewish. He was theistic. He was theistic. And he was raised in the Jewish faith. He never left the Jewish faith. And he believed that how you live in the world, who you are and how you relate to others is what is of the utmost importance. And he believed that God wanted that. Okay, so God wanted human beings to behave in a particular way. That was his belief. That does not take away his belief. Is his own, that's personal. How we believe is so personal and private, but how you behave in the world is what is public. And Jesus behaved as we are told, as we read. We don't know the truth of any of that, but we have the stories that we can look at and say, this individual with this name living in that time, we are told, behaved in this particular way toward people. And we also live in this time, and how do we behave toward people? And what are the things that inspire us to do that, or remind us to do that, or keep us going that path even when it's difficult? So I think it is how humans behave that is what is humanist.
I will say, the last time I went to an American Humanist Association meeting in D.C., I would say when they asked if how many were agnostics or atheists, I would say the majority probably voted in my head. So...
Well, absolutely.
Not doing as good as getting the religious theist humanists out as...
Yeah.
If you unpack the meaning of grace, well, if you think of the hymn that saved a wretch like me, well, if I'm a wretch, I deserve to be punished, and maybe we need an authority to keep my evil impulses in line. So the notion of grace and sin justifies all sorts of awful things.
Mm-hmm. Justifies it, yeah. But I think we have to look at language. I mean, I think we just have to look at language. Language is here for a reason. It's important.
I think language and culture are so tied up with the theology. Gets it, you know, somebody sneezes, we say bless you. Mm-hmm. And when I was in business many years ago with my father, and a big order would come in, he'd sing the doxology, praise God, praise God from whom all blessings flow. And I can, you know, tell you the rest of the verse that he sang too. But also, I so much need to sell that property on Browns Lake in Burlington. If I could sell it, I'd sing the doxology. So the emotion gets into the whole thing too. Could I ask a different question that came to me when you were talking about Sweden? Is there anything that we can learn from the experience in Sweden that would have to do with bringing people in the inner... Waukesha County is going to be easy for you. The people in the inner core in Milwaukee are going to be a different problem. Is there anything that we could learn from Sweden or anybody else? Most of you, I think everybody here knows my wife Margaret. I've had two biracial marriages. I found out that the second marriage is also a bicultural marriage, and there's a difference. My first wife was black, you know, she still is, but her father had a PhD from Harvard, and I married up. My second wife is black. Her father did not have a PhD from Harvard. And she came from the projects in Chicago and has this remarkable and beautiful story of success. All of her family didn't participate in that, and we've had some experiences and disappointments with relationships. But anyway, you know, fine, you're going to erase poverty, but there are people in the inner core, I think it's called the inner core in Milwaukee, inner city, other places, but anyway, the inner core, that are going to be, in my view, quite a challenge. I don't know whether you're going to bring something from Sweden that's going to help.
I don't know either. I haven't done the research yet. No. But I will tell you this, that Sweden is a secular country.
I was going to say, no.
So it is not doing the good because it's religious. It's not thinking about people because it's a religious country. It's a secular country, and it's doing good for people because it's the right way to behave in the world. So it's a humanist culture.
Well, let me just respond.
So I don't know what the challenges are going to be.
Let me say one more thing,
yes,
and then
does.
I'll try and shut up. My wife, Margaret, is every time we're in the inner city, she'll say, look at that. There's a church on every corner, and there's more crime here than anywhere.
Yeah. Right.